My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, as always, Jesse Collings. I am doing a solo show today because I have a mailbag. So I may not have a guest, but I have all of your lovely questions. So in some ways, this isn't a solo show. This is me hosting it with all of my listeners. I did a call out for questions starting last week. I got a lot of responses. A lot of them have to do with wrestling. Some of them don't. Some of them are pretty like deep and like introspective. So I'm really impressed by the kind of thought that people have put into their questions. And some of them I really had to like take some time to actually think about how I wanted to answer them. So we can get started, but I just want to thank everyone who submitted a question, because these aren't just like your normal, like, who is your favorite wrestler? What was the first match you ever saw? Like quick fire questions. These are really well thought out questions. So I appreciate getting them because it shows that my listeners like actually care about what I actually have to say about things, as opposed to just wanting to know some basic information. So it shows that I have an engaged, passionate listener base, which I find pretty remarkable. So thanks to everyone who submitted fine questions. We'll get right into it. We'll start with friend of the show, Alan Forel. Alan Forel asks specifically, do you have a favorite 80s territory? And for people that know me and have listened to this show, this might not come as like a total surprise. I don't really watch territory wrestling. I certainly don't watch it on a regular basis. I don't have any territory where I have like my comfort food, where I'm like, I just want to watch something simple or something I've already seen before, something light, something interesting that I know I'll enjoy. I don't have a go-to territory. I have never been much of a territory guy. I think part of that is because it's you know, you might be able to describe it as a blind spot in my fandom. I don't really like going back and watching like a full hour or 2 hours of something, like watching a whole show. Certainly not like an old show. Obviously watch full shows live as they happen, or shows that are happening, you know, currently, but I don't really go back and watch, like, I'm just going to watch a month of Memphis television from like 1983. That's not something that has ever really appealed to me. And I get that that's something that a lot of people really like, but personally, it's just something that I haven't really ever really wanted to go do. I'm sure I could learn a lot. I'm sure maybe I should try it and I'll end up really liking it. And suddenly I'll be a huge territory geek and I'll be, you know, talking about storylines from 45 years ago. But like when I want to watch old wrestling, and there's so much current wrestling that I feel like I'm constantly behind on, I feel like I have less and less time to watch old wrestling. But when I want to go watch old wrestling, I'm usually watching individual matches, and I'm usually just kind of typing in like somebody whose matches I really want to watch of. Like I would say like Toshiaki Kawada is probably my go-to guy when I'm just like, you know what, it's just I'm bored, let's just turn on some wrestling matches. Some of them maybe I've seen before, some of them I haven't. Let's just go on YouTube, I'll type in Kawada versus and see what comes up, and oh look, I'm watching Kawada versus Steve Williams, or I'm watching, you know, Kawada and Jumbo Tsuruta in a tag earlier in his career, that kind of thing. I would say like, So I don't really go back. I don't watch AWA. I don't watch, you know, Memphis or Mid-South or Jim Crockett Promotions. I feel like when I was a like a teenager when I was like less interested in like watching current like Japanese wrestling or indie wrestling or things like that, when I was more interested, I think, like learning about the history of wrestling, I watched a lot of like Jim Crockett Promotions and AWA and stuff that was available at the time. But I was never like someone that was really into a specific territory. Like the territory that I like watching the most is probably like 2000s Ring of Honor in terms of like having a comfort product that I want to watch. Maybe it doesn't necessarily matter who the wrestlers are, but if I watch some like 2005 Ring of Honor matches, that's probably like that for me is probably how some people feel when they turn on old Mid-South tapes. So maybe part of that might be a generational thing. Part of that just might not, might be a, production thing. I've never really gotten into that kind of like territory stuff that a lot of people are. I'm almost more interested in like surviving tape from like the 60s or before that period than I am from like the TV era or like the national expansion era of pro wrestling. I just is something that I've never really been that interested in. When like Hall of Fame season comes up or somebody dies, like I will just start watching. Like I think like Paul Orndorff is a good example. Like when Paul Orndorff died, I watched a lot of random Paul Orndorff matches from Florida, from Mid-South, obviously WWF, like to get more like, oh, let's see, watch these, let me understand more about Paul Orndorff. I know a lot about him. I've obviously seen his biggest WWF matches, but let's watch more of his matches, especially outside of WWF. And then I'll kind of sample stuff, but I don't really have like a favorite territory that I'm gonna go and watch all the time. The most wrestling that I'm watching from the 80s is All Japan by far. If I'm going back and watching 80s wrestling, it's gonna be something from All Japan. Part of that is accessibility, part of that is video quality, part of that is just you're gonna get so many different types of wrestlers that came through All Japan in the 80s. All basically every major foreign star is going to do a tour there or in New Japan. So that's probably like the 80s territory I like the most is All Japan, but that's not really like a territory in the traditional sense. It's not an American territory, obviously. But yeah, that's probably how I would answer that question. Chris asks, why do you think segments of the commentator slash podcaster class are convinced wrestling is worse than ever? Meanwhile, fans are responding really well to the product in basically every major promotion and many minor ones too. I can't speak to like a whole group of people. I think one thing as a wrestling fan, and just kind of like a, and this can go for a lot of different types of media. It's actually really hard to convince people that something is better than what they originally think. Like, if somebody is like, I don't really like this wrestling promotion, I don't really like this wrestling match or these wrestlers, or I don't really just like the general direction that certain things are going in. That's a personal opinion. It's obviously being influenced by different factors, but it's a personal opinion at its core. And it's going to be really difficult to convince somebody that, oh, you're wrong because this was awesome and this is awesome and I love this and this is why you should like that. It's just difficult to sell people who are at least informed enough to kind of make their own decisions and judgments on things. So it's hard for me to like debate with people like, oh, you think that AEW is bad? Here's why AEW is good. Or you think that this wrestler is bad, here's why this wrestler is actually great. And people are going to change all their time, all the time. So we're talking about like analysts, like your commentators, your podcasters, your pundits on social media, whoever they are. Something I think about a lot, something that Dave Meltzer said when Dave was doing an interview, I think it was a written interview, with somebody several years ago, and they asked him basically like, how are you still interested in pro wrestling? Like, you've been watching pro wrestling for your entire life. You've seen so many changes. The product has evolved so much. Like, how are you still entertained and interested in pro wrestling? And he said, the pro wrestling that you like today is not going to be the pro wrestling that's popular in 5 years. And if you realize that, you can change your expectations that wrestling is, if you really like wrestling, and every single person that's like a commentator, a podcaster, or a pundit likes wrestling. But they got into wrestling at a certain time, or they got really more into wrestling at another period in their life. And wrestling's not going to stay the same. It is going to constantly evolve. What works is going to influence how other people work. The biggest companies are going to influence the smaller ones. All that is going to happen. And there is a point where you're going to reach where like wrestling's just not going to be for you. And I think if you're talking to like a lot of commentators, like just to use like the Cornette class of person before, clearly the wrestling industry has passed those people by. They really like wrestling. Like, who likes wrestling more than Jim Cornette spent his entire life? But what has become popular has just completely passed those people by. And I don't know if they can accept that. It seems like a lot of them can't because they're constantly pining for, the good old days, whatever that was. But it's going to constantly evolve and change, and there's really nothing I feel like you can do to change those people's minds. They're either going to adapt and find new interests in wrestling, and maybe they, switch promotions. I used to watch this promotion, but it turned this way, and I started getting into this thing. Or maybe they just stop watching wrestling altogether. But I think eventually wrestling is going to pass most people by. And you really need, I think about that Dave Meltzer mentality, which is like, wrestling is it's gonna keep changing. It's not gonna stay the same, just the same way music isn't gonna stay the same, just the same way as film isn't gonna stay the same, just the same way as movies or video games or television or anything like that isn't gonna stay the same forever. It's gonna constantly be evolving, and it might improve, it might get worse. It really depends on what your individual preferences are. There's some stuff I really like about wrestling in 2026. There's some stuff that I really don't like about wrestling in 2026. I'll kind of get into that a little bit later. There's some related questions to that that we'll touch on that subject a little bit more, but really good question to kind of start that conversation. Connor, this is of course in Northern Ireland, Connor, not to be confused with Republic of Ireland, Dublin-based Connor, but this is Northern Ireland Connor. By the way, most of these people submitted questions through the Voices of Wrestling Discord or on my Discord page within that Discord, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. So if you want to submit a question to a future pod mailbag when I call out for them, that's a great place to put them in. You can also DM me on Discord. I'm also on Blue Sky. I put this question out on Blue Sky, so some of the other questions came from Blue Sky. So if you do want to participate in one of these in the future, I suggest either joining the Discord or following me on Blue Sky as ways to kind of get a handle on when I'm going to do those kind of call outs. But Connor asks, I know you're a books and movie guy. I'm a film guy, Connor. Let's get that right. What are you reading right now, and anything in particular in your plans to read just in 26? Currently, the book I'm reading is a book called The Graves Are Walking. It's by John Kelly, who's a historian, and it's about the Irish potato famine, which I assume most people are at least passing knowledge about. I'm becoming a lot more interested in like the history of Ireland. My family's from Ireland. I know kind of like the basic history things about Ireland, but I don't know really that much about like broader history and things like that. So I really like to read nonfiction, and I like to read nonfiction because I like to learn. And so I always like to find a subject that I'm interested in and want to read more about it. So I'm starting with this book on the potato famine, which is interesting in the sense it's very focused on like the bureaucratic nature of how a lot of like British colonial government officials responded to the potato famine, and kind of what are the different factors that made it as devastating as it was. And I'm about like probably like 75% of the way through the book. But there's a lot of discussions about the Irish like economy and Irish society was really underdeveloped comparative to other parts of Europe in the 1840s when this happened. It had not been industrialized to nearly the same degree that England had or other countries in Europe. It was still relying on a very large peasant class of farmers that were basically subsistence farmers, and they grew the potato, which was responsible for an enormous amount of their diet. The potato is really versatile. It's very nutritious in the sense for peasant food. It's very cheap. It's easy to grow. It can grow in adverse conditions. Of course, this disease comes up, kills the potato crop, and all of a sudden, Ireland just kind of devolves into horrifying chaos where everyone is starving, and food prices go up. And it's really interesting. It's a rebuke of like a lot of like capitalism and free market and laissez-faire approach to the economy, because the British officials who are running Ireland at the time are really reluctant to interfere with things like the price, skyrocketing price of food because of the limited supply in Ireland. There's a lot of anti-Irish sentiment coming out of British government. There's like I was reading a passage the other day, and it was like a lot of people in Britain viewed the potato famine as this providential moment by God, where God was angry at the Irish for being, sinful Irishmen, and the potato famine was being done to punish all of them. And there was one British official who was quoted as saying he was very upset that Irish people were fleeing Ireland to go to England, or in a lot of cases, go to America or go to Canada. And he was mad because he was like, God sent this pestilence upon you Irishmen for you to suffer, and you guys are cheating him by fleeing away. You should stay there and die. That's not exactly what he said, but that was the gist of what he said. And I was just like, wow, these people really hate the Irish, which of course I knew. But if you I guess if you were a fan of early Victorian era British bureaucratic officials, this is not the book for you, because they did not come off across in a flattering light. And just in general, kind of reemphasizes that like some of the absolute worst people in the history of society were like people in the British government during colonial periods. Like they say and do some of the most heinous, awful stuff that's on the level of any like crazy genocidal dictator that you could name. So that's what I'm reading right now. I've been reading, trying to get into more fiction over the last few years. It's more difficult for me to find fiction because sometimes I'll read a book and it's just hard for me to get into, as opposed to a nonfiction book, where if I'm interested in the subject, I'm probably going to be interested in the book. There's like a 90% kind of confidence rate in that I'm not going to be interested in the book, even if I maybe don't really like the author that much or anything like that. But in fiction, it's much more reliant on, am I invested in these characters? Do I feel like the author is entertaining me? So I'm more reluctant to do that. I will say I really like historical fiction. My favorite author is James Michener, who is probably best known for writing the novel South Pacific, which was then turned into the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. But he has written many, many really lengthy, deep, immaculately researched historical fictional books. I think Hawaii is probably his most well known from that, but he has a bunch. I just finished Colorado, or I'm sorry, it's called Centennial, but it's about the state of Colorado. And he does like, big time jumps and multi-generational characters and things like that, and it's really good. So I don't really know what I'm gonna read in 2026. One of my joys is I like going to the library and just looking through books and trying to find the right book. That's a simple pleasure that I have. So that's really what I'm reading. I know people definitely tuned into this podcast to hear me pontificate about the causes of the Irish potato famine, but Connor actually knows that's the book I'm reading, so I think he actually just wanted to hear that. So everyone else who listened to that was along for the ride. Super Dan 91 writes, how do you feel about the homogenization of modern wrestling as a whole? While the quality of work and overall athleticism across the board is the highest it's ever been historically, there is also overall samey feel in everyone's in-ring work, with a lot less thought placed in how to make matches memorable beyond the calendar year. I do think that in general, when people ask questions like this, what they're getting on, especially when they mention like homogenization of modern wrestling, is we have reached a point in wrestling where certainly the most curious and best wrestlers about and the people who put the most thought into their work have access and familiarity with all different types of pro wrestling. So if you turn on like an AEW pay-per-view and see two guys, let's say like a Kyle Fletcher is wrestling, I don't know who you want to say, Mark Briscoe, they've had a lot of matches. So let's just say those guys. You're gonna see those guys do this, like what kind of style are they wrestling? It's like this hybrid style where you're gonna see moves that they clearly lifted from like traditional Puro. You're gonna see moves that they clearly lifted from Lucha Libre. You're gonna see moves that they lifted from, traditional territorial American wrestling. You're gonna see stuff that was adopted from different, like, 2000s early independent wrestling. Certainly Mark Briscoe is gonna do that since he's one of those, prominent figures from that era. But you're just gonna see just all of this type of wrestling blending into one style, and it's kind of become the dominant style, especially at in the largest promotions, and there's not as much room for variety in that case. And it seems like if you really want variety in wrestling styles, you have to like look at like more experimental style wrestling, like the deathmatch scene or these like Joshi shows that are being wrestled, like the was it Gato Move? Like you're watching like these they're wrestling in a dentist's office, or these much more kind of experimental style of wrestling the promotions than necessarily in the main mix of things. And I don't know like how we go back to that. Like I don't know if the like we can't just go back and make everyone more ignorant of other types of wrestling. I mean, like that's what the WWE kind of wants to do, right? WWE wants to train and program every wrestler they have in like the WWE style of pro wrestling. And it's they want they've talked about how they want to like, basically deprogram wrestlers who come from other backgrounds, learn the WWE style, learn the house style, and that's what you're going to do because that's what everyone does. And so if you want to see a different type of wrestling, you can watch like Main Event WWE wrestling, because that's different. I mean, you got these guys cutting these long promos in the middle of matches and these mic'd up things and everyone doing the yeet dance in the middle of a War Games match or whatever. So like there's not homogenization there necessarily. But I don't know if we can like undo that. Like I don't know if we're gonna be like we should I don't know if we should want to do it. I mean, I think it's just a reality that we have to come to grips with, that wrestling is going to be less diverse stylistically because in a lot of ways it's blended into one. It's kind of like making me think of like this a South Park episode where these people come from the future, like centuries into the future, and from the and like the people all like look exactly the same. They're all these kind of like tan colored bald people, and they speak all the same language, and it's kind of this incomprehensible gibberish. Ironic that I struggled to say that. And like it's just because all races and all languages have blended into one, and this is just what everyone in the future looks exactly the same. And that kind of feels like we're looking at wrestling where all these styles have blended into looking exactly the same. And I don't know. As long as the wrestling is good, and as long as the wrestling is entertaining, I don't really care that much about the style. But I think what Super Dan is kind of talking about is like making stuff feel different. And I think you see that more, like almost like an under, especially like an undercard matches, like. You'll see more like, okay, this is a match with like a 70-30 layout, right? It's not a 50-50 match. It's not a squash. It's one guy beating up another guy for like 70 minutes and controlling 70% of the match and controlling that match. And like, I get a little hope spots in, but he loses. It does seem like we're stuck in 50-50 matches, or especially at the main event level, like these, like every match's gotta be like 20, 25 minutes or longer. Kickouts after finishers. You can't have a match now where just one guy hits his finisher and that's it. It's got to be this long, dramatic, kind of way to pull it out. And we've seen some really, really incredible matches using that model, but there definitely is a sameness to it. And I wouldn't be adverse to at least some experiments in terms of match layout. To like could AEW have a pay-per-view main event that ends in 6 minutes and it's not like Like, wow, like that would be a risk. Like, how would fans respond to that? Like, would they get mad about like the match would not being that long? Would there be fans that'd be like, oh my God, they squashed so and so because the match was only 6 minutes long? Like, it takes some real courage and conviction to try to do something like that. And I think a lot of these bigger promotions, especially, are risk averse. They don't want to be dragged on social media for it. The wrestlers themselves don't want to try that kind of risky type of layout. But when I watch, there was like a, oh, I forget who she wrestles, but it was Chihiro Hashimoto wrestling some other woman in Japan. And like, it's a fun match. It's a main event match. It's like 12 minutes long, and she just hits a power slam and wins. And I remember telling somebody at the time, I was like, oh, it's really refreshing that that's what the finish of that match was. It wasn't like this super drawn out, trying to do an epic, trying to do Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 25 with all these finisher kickouts. It was like, we're going to wrestle, and then I'm just going to hit this move, and you're not going to be able to get up for a three count. And yeah, like I'd be okay. I'd be open to seeing more of that just because it would get us away from this, stylistic similarities that are very pervasive throughout all of modern wrestling. Avengers 23 says, we have tons of movies about amateur and professional sports, but we don't have a signature movie about professional wrestling other than The Wrestler. Is this lack due to how pro wrestling is considered low culture? If The Wrestler isn't the most significant movie about professional wrestling, what is? The Wrestler is the most significant movie about pro wrestling. And I think what makes it so what made it makes it the signature movie, what has made it popular is that The Wrestler is not really it's not really that focused on pro wrestling as much as it could be kind of about any old entertainer. You could make The Wrestler, but make it about a guy who was a rock star in the 80s, but is now playing really small clubs in the 2000s. And the movie would probably be almost exactly the same. And I think that's what's made it accessible. I think that it mostly comes down to what Avengers says, which is like pro wrestling is considered low culture. We have a billion boxing movies. I think there are more movies about boxing than any other sport. But the limited amount of wrestling movies is probably due because when you make it, you're like, wrestling's like lowbrow. It's not that interesting to the average person. Some people know it's fake, so they're not going to be that interested in it. The stigma that kind of sticks with pro wrestling, it doesn't stick with other things that we've kind of talked about a lot on this podcast before, is probably keeping it from being made into too many movies. Like the Iron Claw came out. I would say that was a pretty significant movie. It was made by a prestige, movie studio in A24, and it came out around Oscar award season. Didn't really get a lot of award traction, but was, I think, like a really legitimate pro wrestling movie. And that movie is really about pro wrestling. I don't think you could make that movie a similar movie about anything else. It's obviously based on a true story, and based on like the Von Erichs and things like that, but that is definitely a wrestling movie. I mean, there are other movies that are like really dumb, like Ready to Rumble, that are about pro wrestling to an extent. But I know there's a Ed Asner movie called The Wrestler that he made in the early 70s, which he made like in kind of in collaboration with the AWA. There's a lot of AWA wrestlers in it, and I think Ed Asner, I think he plays a wrestling promoter in it. And it is very much like exposes the business because, it doesn't pretend that pro wrestling is real, which is interesting that like Vern Gagne of all people went along with that. But if you're interested in the AWA, which I just told everyone about 10 minutes ago that I was not that interested in, it is a somewhat interesting movie. I don't know if it is available anywhere. But I had a chance to interview Ed Asner for the shoot job a couple years ago, and I asked him about that movie, and he like couldn't believe that someone was asking about that movie because when people interview Ed Asner, they mostly want to talk about like the Mary Tyler Moore Show or him on Lou Grant or like the things that he's really famous for. Not probably one of his more forgettable films, but they started telling me about going to wrestling matches in the 1940s in Kansas City and seeing Luthes and the Swedish Angel, and it was a really interesting conversation. But yeah, I mean, like there's been discussions about like who's. I think there's plenty of like topics for movies to be made out of. I know Dave has mentioned like Bruno Sammartino's life is an incre would be an incredible movie because of the way he was raised and growing up in, Italy during World War II, and having to, like, I think he like lived in a mountain for 2 years, and his mother had to like sneak out and get food for them, and eventually emigrating to America as a teenager and getting bullied, and that t introducing him into weight training, and then obviously becoming, one of the biggest wrestling stars in the history of the business. Like, if that was about someone that wasn't a pro wrestler but was about like a musician that was super famous and sold out arenas all the time, like Bruno Sammartino did, we probably would have had multiple movies about their life. But because it is about a wrestler, we haven't seen it. But yeah, no, I think, like, as a film guy, like, I think there'd be a nice aesthetic story focused on like turn of the century carnival wrestlers. Like, the whole take on any challenger. If you could best this man, you win $5 or whatever. Like, traveling carnival, like that kind of aesthetic, could be used, I think, really well for a film. If a filmmaker wanted to take a chance on something, I think a period piece focusing on that kind of like re the real carny aspect of pro wrestling, from the, the William Muldoon era of pro wrestling, or the Colonel McLaughlin era of pro wrestling, the original Strangler Lewis, Evan Strangler Lewis, all these like turn of the century style wrestlers, would be interesting idea for a movie. If I had like unlimited money, I'd produce a movie like that. Travis William asks, does cheating matter anymore? It feels like fans only care about the end result, and that a heel winning a match by cheating has the exact same legitimacy of a baby face winning clean as a sheet. I think it mostly doesn't. I think Travis is right in the sense that the end result doesn't seem that much different. I think that we've just now have decades of like the cool heel and people being into cheering for heels that. And we have the tweener and the anti-hero, and that, like, the idea of like a wrestler cheating, and in general, the morality of a wrestler being inherently good or inherently evil, or doing good acts versus doing bad acts, hasn't mattered in some time in pro wrestling. I think, like, if you look at, like, there was a spot on Dynamite last week where John Moxley was wrestling, now I can't remember who he was wrestling, but he was wrestling somebody good, somebody that was interesting. And now I can't remember. Oh, he's wrestling El Clone. So he's wrestling El Clone. And I think there's a spot like where now Moxley, of course, is a babyface, El Clone is a heel. And like, there's a spot where they go into the corner, and El Clone stands on the turnbuckles, and he takes like the tag rope and wraps it around Moxley's neck and starts choking him with it. Like, okay, all right, classic heel cheating shtick. And Tony Schiavone's whining about it, and then I think it's Nigel McGuinness is saying like, "Look, you're whining about something that Jon Moxley himself would totally be okay with doing." And Jon Moxley's a babyface, and I think that kind of points out like. Yeah, like nobody really cares if this guy, the people cheat or not. It's used, I feel like cheating is used as a booking crutch to protect wrestlers. Like, oh, we want this heel to go over this baby face, but we don't want to beat this baby face clean, because that will mean something that we don't want to set, we don't want it to. So we're going to make sure that the heel wins, but he cheats, so the baby face has an excuse. Which, in a lot of ways, when you think about it, is like really, really old fashioned from a philosophical point of view. Like, if a heel just beats a baby face, like wrestlers, wrestling fans know that wrestling's not real, okay? They're not going, they shouldn't be like, oh no, that babyface lost, he's a loser, as opposed to if the heel cheats, what a wrestling fan's gonna be like, oh, that wrestler's not a loser, it's because that guy cheated and he's a bastard. Like, a heel could just beat a babyface, and like, we can accept that in this instance, this babyface lost a test of grappling skill to another skilled competitor. Like, but for some reason we have to protect the business, and be like, oh yeah, babyface didn't only lost because of cheating. So it's kind of dumb in a lot of ways, but I think we just had decades, like I said, of the cool heel, of the tweener heel, of the babyface that cheats all the time anyway. Like, It definitely doesn't matter anymore. It seems like it's mostly used as a booking crutch, and like, what am I gonna like outlaw cheating? Like, obviously that's stupid. Like, that's a it's been a part of wrestling for a century. So obviously I don't think it's going to change anytime soon, but it does feel like, a lot of the cheating and a lot of the stuff is just like a heel going through the motions as opposed to putting like real thought into it. Like, I think it's easy to sell yourself as a heel. Like, if you're like, oh, I'm gonna choke this guy with the ring rope. Okay. Fans will probably like lightly boo that, as opposed to, I'm a heel because I carry myself a certain way. I'm able to exude this kind of loathsome charisma about me. I'm able to, produce my offense in such a way that people just feel uncomfortable and like, this guy's just nasty and vile and evil, as opposed to like, cheating, which is a shortcut. Right, I'm gonna poke this guy in the eye. I'm gonna, hit a low blow. I'm gonna, have my manager come in and do like a little interference or things like that. That's all, it's cheap heat, right? That's what it's basically called that for a reason. And it's used as a crutch for a lot of people. But like, the morality of the characters doesn't matter anymore. Wrestling fans are invested in who they think is interesting and cool. And that can be a bad guy or it could be a good guy. Doesn't matter. But that's who ultimately they're gonna gravitate towards. Like, pick a baby face. Like, people like supporting John Moxley because they think he's fucking cool. Okay? It has nothing to do with whether John Moxley is a cheating asshole or he's the most honest person in the world. Hangman Adam Page, people like that guy because they think he's cool, right? Roman Reigns, Tribal Chief Roman Reigns, cheated in every single one of his matches. Still was the most popular wrestler in the company, basically. Had all his fans putting the one finger in the air when he'd come out. Didn't matter that he cheated every time. People thought he was cool, so that's what they bought into. Wrestling is about doing cool moves and looking like a badass. And you can cheat and still look like a badass. Kaze Ni Nair asks, what are some things from your shoot job that you think pro wrestling could take to enhance himself? This is a really interesting question because I don't really think like this anything from my job being a journalist that would apply like to the wrestling industry in general. Like, I wish the professional wrestling industry was more transparent and less secretive. I think that would help the industry in general be more successful. As opposed to the behind closed door atmosphere that still permeates across basically every promotion. But I was thinking about this, like, let's just focus more on wrestling media because obviously there's a direct comparison between the work I do and the work that's going on in the wrestling media. And I jotted down like just a couple things. Like, one of the ones is like, and I talk about this all the time, like, be professional and take pride in your work. If you are work producing any type of work in professional wrestling media space, whether that is you're attending a show live, filming something or reporting on something, whether you're working as an aggregator for one of these numerous sites, whether you're producing a podcast, whatever, you're writing an article, whatever you're doing, take the approach that I want to be a professional at this and my work is really important and valuable. That's just the first thing you should say to yourself every time. Because if not, you're going to half-ass it and you're going to allow yourself to make mistakes that you shouldn't. And you should hold yourself to a high standard and you should like really take pride in, I'm going to try to produce the best product, whatever that is, the best piece of content that I possibly can. The second thing is like, from like a be professional perspective, like, don't be like when I go to AEW shows and I am there as media, like, I'm, wearing khakis and a collared shirt and having a notebook and my press pass out. I am not wearing wrestling merchandise. I am not cheering along to the show. Like, I'm there to work. I'm a professional. I'm not there to be a fan. I was talking to my parents the other day about how I may have the opportunity to attend a World Cup game as media, because the World Cup is obviously coming to the United States. It's coming to Foxborough, and I was talking about it with my employer about, potentially getting to go to a game and covering it. I think like the Ghana versus England game would be interesting because Worcester, Mass, which is the city I cover has a large Ghanaian population, and we could profile some of them as they go to the Ghana versus England World Cup game, because when else is Ghana going to be playing a national soccer game, 30 minutes from where these people live? And I was telling my parents that, and I was like, oh yeah, and they'll be interviewing England, so I'll get to interview like Harry Kane, who most people know I'm a huge Tottenham Hotspur fan. Harry Kane's one of my three or four favorite athletes of all time. I'd love the chance to meet him. And my dad was like, oh yeah, make sure to wear your Harry Kane jersey while you're interviewing him. And I'm like, and I was joking and I was laughing. I was like, Dad, that's what the wrestling media would do. Which he doesn't understand really what that means, but it popped me when I said it. So that's what I mean, kind of, when you want to be professional. Like, you're there as a professional, not as a fan. You can be a fan. Like, I'm a fan of pro wrestling, obviously, but you're there to be professional first. Another piece of advice: ask difficult questions. A non-answer is still an answer. I don't know how many times we've heard this rebuttal when people talk about the questions back when people like Paul Levesque took questions from the media, which he doesn't anymore. We're like, why would I waste my question on something he's not going to answer? Well, if he doesn't answer it, that is still an answer. If, quick story, had an opportunity to potentially interview Linda McMahon last week. She was supposed to come to one of the school districts that I cover for my shoot job. And she ended up not coming for like really dumb reasons that I won't get into here. But I was like saying, like, oh, like if she comes, like, I want to ask her about the Ring Boy scandal. Like, she's currently named in this lawsuit for rehiring Mel Phillips, who she allegedly told that he could have his job back as long as he stayed away from children, which he didn't do. And I wanted to ask her about that. And I very highly doubt Linda McMahon would offer a substantive answer to any question regarding Mel Phillips and the Ring Boy scandal. But even so, you gotta ask the question, because if she said that she had no comment on that question, that's going in the paper, that's going in the newspaper, that she's involved in this lawsuit and she's named for this incident that involved a pretty, allegedly pretty serious, sexual assault on minors. That would be that we got a report that she has nothing to say about that. So always ask difficult questions. A non-answer is still an answer. Another important tip: understand what is news, what is gossip, and what info is relevant to your readers. I know that it can be really tempting to post like very clickbaity things and little pieces of gossip that will attract readership. I know that this whole thing is just a rat race, which I'll talk about in a second, to try to generate as much, clicks and interest and retweets as possible. But I think in the long run, it's obviously more sustainable for you to build an audience that trusts you, that knows that when they follow you on social media, or they go to your website, or they watch your YouTube channel, or they listen to your podcast, that your stuff is important, that your stuff is relevant, that your stuff is not just trying to squeeze something out of fleeting fan interest. And I think that's an important thing. And like, judgment's so important. Like, judgment is so important as a journalist. It's one of the most important skills, especially if you're working in one of these like news aggregation fields, or you're getting information from somebody. Like, understanding, okay, how important is it? Is this to my readers? Is this going to be something that people are going to be interested in? How factual? How much can I confirm? How much of this information is truthful that we can feel comfortable running it in a news setting? And what are like the potential ramifications if we do run the story? Are we going to get blowback? Is the wrestler going to be mad at us? Is that something that I want to deal with? All that stuff, in understanding a judgment in what is important for your role. Again, be professional, take pride in your work. What are you producing? Understanding what is important and using proper judgment is critical to any journalist. And then lastly, I think it's going to be really difficult going forward, I think, to make like to break into the wrestling news industry as like a news aggregator or as a content creator. The industry's going away. Things are being consolidated. Websites are being sold. Fans are going to be, peddling being pushed towards a few companies that control media. This is across the sphere. And just in general, like for my job and seeing what we're trained on and like kind of what's being pushed, and people talk about like, oh, AI is going to replace your job. AI is going to write things. And like, that's maybe true. But you know what AI is already doing? It's controlling SEO. It's making sure that all of our articles, articles that are being written are written not for people, but written for machines. You're writing it for the AI algorithm of some search engine to enjoy it and slap it on, recommended for people searching things, for people that are using Google Discover, for people that are looking for something on any kind of social media search feature. Everything is being done because you're trying to basically write for machines who will then hopefully cross your fingers, relate that to real humans who presumably are going to eventually, I guess, pay for your content. It just seems like we're really fucked on a lot of these different things. But yeah, that's I don't know, advice. Things for my shoot job, I guess that might apply to the wrestling media. Tail Avery asks, discuss your top three favorite New England winter activities outside of skiing slash snowboarding. So this is interesting because I'm obviously a big skier. That's definitely like my primary activity, I would say, that is inherent to the winter and inherent, obviously done in New England. I ski a bunch. I'll be skiing. I'll be going up to Vermont this weekend, to ski again. But other things I like to do in New England in the wintertime. So think about this, like I don't really like doing a lot of other stuff outside. Like I don't snowshoe, I don't snowmobile, I don't play like pond hockey, I don't go ice fishing, like these other kind of recreational activities you do in the wintertime. So I picked, these are like three kind of like simple pleasures that I get out of the wintertime. I like just walking through the city and feeling that cold air and take it all in, especially if it's like the weather's not that great. Maybe it's, wintry mix is coming down or something. But I like, I'll take my lunch break. I'll go and I'll do a little lap around the building, in downtown Worcester. And I will just, take a few deep breaths and really like get hit with that cold air and just, I don't know. It's just something that I find very relaxing about it. I think like there's just like this kind of inherent toughness that comes from the cold, right? You go outside and you get hit with that, it's 20 degrees and your skin gets immediately reacted to the cold. And you take that breath and you feel all that cold air in your lungs. And I just think it, I don't know, builds character. Obviously, I like it when it's nice outside. I like when it's warm outside. I don't begrudge anyone who is like, yeah, I love living in an area where, it's always, at least 70 degrees and sunny. But there's anyone that lives in like a northern city, I think might be able to relate to like, there's just something about the growing up, especially if you grow up in the area, like, this is my city, this is my weather, this is how I was raised. I was born in this cold climate, and I am going to appreciate this. I don't know, it's very vibesy, it's kind of hard to describe. Also vibesy, like we got a lot of snow this year. We've gotten storms of 20 and 16 inches respectively, on two different occasions. So a lot of shoveling this year. I love the days where you get hit with a ton of snow, you spend all day inside because you can't really go anywhere, and then you go out and you just bust your ass shoveling. That nice feeling of cleaning off the driveway, getting your car brushed off, even if it's a lot of work, that there's just this nice relaxing feeling of you're inside all day, you go out, you feel that fresh air, you work up a sweat, you do hard work, and then you get to come back inside, take a nice hot shower, put on some pajamas, drink some coffee or hot chocolate or whatever, and relax again. I'm the kind of person that obviously likes like my cozy time and likes relaxing, but I also like I can't sit still for the whole day. I need to at least do something each day. So this is a really nice compromise where you do get to relax and chill inside, but you also feel the satisfaction of putting in some hard work that comes with shoveling. And once you kind of get to after that feeling afterwards where you come and take a shower and then you get to warm up, there's just a nice sense of satisfaction that I wouldn't have if I lived in an area that had nice weather all the time. Lastly, I like taking a hot shower, and I like taking a hot shower. There's like a in my bathroom, right, on the wall, adjacent to the bathtub, there's a window, and I like to pull the window down, and it only goes down to like, I don't know, like maybe like my nose or something like that. So it's not really like a scandalous window that's exposing myself to the neighbors, but I like when it's really cold out, and especially maybe if we're getting some weather, like if it's raining or snowing, pulling that window down and then having the shower running hot. That nice like contrast of the cold air, warm shower. It's kind of like, going in a jacuzzi or hot tub during the winter time. You just kind of get that really nice, satisfying feeling of the temperature change, and it's very relaxing to me. So those are my New England winter activities, none of which are really activities, but just like weird vibes based like mental exercises in a lot of way. Olsen FG writes, "Why is Mystico such a huge star? I mean, obviously he's a huge star. I just don't understand the appeal. Granted, I'm a casual at best CML watcher, but whenever I see him in promotions, I do follow. He seems less skilled or charismatic than Soberano, Hechicero, Cavernario, etc." So I'm obviously like not the best person to answer this because I'm not a huge lucha guy. But I think a lot of the stuff with Mystico seems really simple. Like CMLL is a very old-fashioned traditional promotion built around really old-fashioned traditional ideals with pro wrestling. And Mystico is, in a lot of ways, a throwback to like a Hulk Hogan or a Bruno Sammartino or your typical super babyface character who is always the most pushed guy, always the top guy, pretty much never loses, knows how to work the crowd, knows how to fire up the audience, knows how to get them on his side, knows how to, work with his opponent to get heat on him so he can make his comeback. He's got a giant ego. He always thinks he should be going over, which most top guys have. Not saying that's a bad thing. And so I just think that goes into like, I think he, in some ways, he's, I don't know if his character could exist on like American television wrestling because the business is so different. And I think there'd be way more resentment for somebody that's presented like Mystico, the same way there was a lot of resentment for like Super Cena when John Cena was a full-time wrestler. But it's really, I think, just that simple of obviously he's a really talented individual and he's got great charisma and crowd connection, but it's just that he's been, he's consistently pushed, he's been around for a long time. He's always kind of billed as the top guy, pushed as top guy, and he's super protected. And it's not a complicated formula, really. And he's definitely needed that environment to be successful. We saw, when he left CMLL the first time, he goes to WWE, disaster, doesn't take off at all. And then after that, he was kind of like bouncing around, like he went to AAA. So he went back to Mexico, where he was already a big star, and he didn't feel the same way, he didn't hit the same way, really struggled, was basically a bust in AAA. And then he goes back to CMLL. He's not Mystico because they've given that character to somebody else, so he's Caristico. And eventually he ends up being Mystico again, and once that happens, he gets back in front of the audience, back in front of the big crowd, and he is able to kind of, in a long roundabout way, reassert his dominance as the top babyface in CMLL, the same way he was, in the mid-2000s before he left to go to WWE. So I think it's really just that simple. It's like it's a traditional environment, and he is the most traditionally pushed wrestler, and he's the top babyface, and he's the stereotypical never lose, Lucha Libre babyface. You can go back to El Santo or Mil Máscaras. That guy has always been super popular and over. So that's what I think is how to summarize Mystico's appeal. People that are more regular CML watchers will be able to, I think, get into more detail with that. But to me, he's just, the traditional top babyface, and has been for a long time. Prince asks, "With the death of High Spots TV, is there really a space for U.S. independent wrestling subscription services, knowing how IWTV has struggled in recent years? Or is YouTube and Fight Eye pay-per-views the way to go instead? What is the future?" I think a lot of this has to do with interest in the indies and less to do with like a paywalled access to the indies. I think that if the indies still had a good selection of the best wrestlers in the world, or and had some of the best matches you're going to see anywhere, that there would still be a much healthier market for premium top level indie wrestling. Like if PWG was still in its prime, you would see more of a demand for indie wrestling. But the fact is, indie wrestling isn't providing the best wrestling in the world. Indie wrestling isn't providing the best wrestlers. Indie wrestling isn't providing the most interesting storylines. That stuff is all happening elsewhere than US indie wrestling. And so that has manifested itself in a lot less of an interest in it. And I think that is probably the main driver why a lot of promotions are looking at, like, let's just go to YouTube. It's the most accessible platform we could possibly be on, and let's just try to get our product out there. And I know that some have set up, Patreon pages, and you can now be kind of like a super fan on YouTube and be a supporter right directly on YouTube. So there's ways to make revenue out of your biggest fans, but it does seem like, this is in some ways a reversion back to at least the indies that I have gone to are focused on selling tickets. They're focused on putting people in the building as opposed to being an online success and drawing a national or international audience, which you definitely saw as was a attempt and something that a lot of indie companies wanted to do in the 2010s when indie wrestling was far more popular. So I don't see like a prescription service really taking off. Look, like most indie companies don't make money. It's a huge burden to have. It's why there aren't a lot of successful indie promotions. It's why they go through different owners all the time, and why a lot of companies start and then don't run again, or go through huge periods where they don't run. It's not a economically sound business to be in. So it is not like a ton of money to be made in indie wrestling in general if you're a promoter. So it's even harder if you're going to be making trying to make money off of like a High Spots TV or like an IWTV, where you're like, yeah, we're going to be providing broadcasting rights to all these different indie promotions. It's just really difficult. I think YouTube is the way to go because it's at least giving fans an access point that if they want to invest further in their shows or they want to go to a show, my local indie, Chaotic Wrestling, which has been around forever but seems to be at least growing under new management, and it seems to be more professionalized as opposed to just kind of being like a typical like wrestling school based indie. They probably do about 200 fans on the shows that I go to, and they pack them in there. They run a Sons of Italy Hall, which for people who don't know, is like an Elks Lodge or a Lions Club or Rotary Club kind of hall, or VFW hall, but it's for founded by Italian immigrants, which is why it's called the Sons of Italy. So like they draw pretty well, I would say, for a local indie that isn't really relying on that much outside star power. Like I think like the show last show that they had on Friday, like Tasha Steelz was like their name wrestler that they brought in, someone who had wrestled on T wrestles in TNA occasionally. But it's their shows are on YouTube, and they're streamed live on YouTube, and you can watch them immediately on YouTube. And I don't know if that's successful for them, but it's at least bringing them more easier to bring their access to other people, especially people like myself who are local, who might watch a show on YouTube and be like, oh, that show is actually pretty good. And look, they run, just one town over from me. I mean, they run like 5 minutes from me, but if I'm in the area, I would see it and be like, ah, maybe I'll go to their next show. And I feel like that's the way to go, is just to bring access to fans as opposed to paywalling it, just because you don't have the product that right now, you do not have the product where you can put it behind a paywall. You just can't. And I think that's what a lot of these indie streamers are going to learn and have been learning. Michael Horgan says, who are some under 30 folks you think are actually ready for this elevation that everyone seems to agree we need with young talent? Any company, any country, ideally give me one for each major company to build around. I'm not so one thing first thing I want to say is I'm not as focused on like the raw age of like, oh, they got to be under 30. I would think more of like who is there that hasn't been pushed as a top wrestler before. And that's the kind of person that I would be interested in elevating to the next level so that we don't feel like we're pushing the same guys, the main event scene doesn't grow stale, we're giving these wrestlers with potential a major opportunity to become one of the biggest stars in the industry. So that's what we're looking at. Like an AEW, I think the three guys that immediately come to mind to me, Kyle Fletcher, Brody King, Konosuke Takeshita. And I think those guys are in some ways all on trajectory to do that. I think that Tony has shown that he's really methodical in the way that he wants to elevate talent and that all these guys are on like these longer journeys to eventually maybe becoming world champion. But those are three names that I definitely build around their they check a lot of the boxes that you want, but they're also all really different, right? Kyle Fletcher, Brody King, Konosuke Takeshita are all like really interesting, different types of wrestlers. With kind of come from different backgrounds, and their appeal can be different. You can have babyface, you can have a heel. That's the three guys that I would build around if I was AEW. New Japan, I would say like the three guys that come to mind for me are. That aren't like I think Yota Tsuji is really good, so and I think that he's the world champion right now, so it's kind of hard to say like, oh, they should build around him when it seems like that's clearly something they're gonna do. I think the guys that I see on the New Japan roster, Yuya Uemura, Bolton Olig, Aaron Wolf. I think I'll say this, like Aaron, I watched the Aaron Wolf Don Fale match today. I can't believe Aaron Wolf lost. I don't know what they're doing with that guy. I kind of refuse to believe that he is so green that he just can't do anything right, and the only thing he can do is kind of like wrestle these shtick matches with House of Torture, and so we're gonna have him keep losing to them to prolong that feud while he gets his legs under him. I just kind of refuse to believe that's the best optimal way for them to use him. I have seen no evidence so far in his limited in-ring time to suggest that he's not capable of having like a controlled, solid 8-minute match at this stage of his career. That's just me. Can't believe so I don't know what they're doing with that guy. New Japan's at the point where like especially with the way they've handled Aaron Wolf and the way that they seem committed to reestablishing House of Torture post Evil, that like anything about their booking and I would believe it. Like it's at the point where they have made so many seemingly out of nowhere boneheaded decisions that are against all types of traditional booking logic. That you could tell me kind of their plans for anything, and I would believe it. I talked a lot about Bolton Olig last week or on last episode with J. Michael, so I'm not going to really reiterate too many points. Other than that, I think that he is someone that really needs to be protected in his booking because he's so physically impressive and he's so athletic and smooth that. It strains credibility for him to not just win every match in 5 minutes because he just comes across as such an incredible athlete and ass kicker. In Yuya Uemura, I think, like I said, everyone is, I think, pretty confident. Again, can't rule anything out with New Japan booking that Yuya Uemura is going to be pushed as a big star. So I feel good about that. WWE, it's really hard because they've done such a shit job of establishing these younger guys. Like I think to me Bron Breakker's a super prospect. I think he's really, you know, got great physicality, great look, comes across really sincere and as a badass. I think there's some charisma there. It's not all the way there with promos and stuff like that, and I don't know how it's going to get there because their system is just so bad at developing talent that it's really hard for me to think about that, but he is obviously to me like the building block for WWE. We'll see with Javon Evans. I mean, they called up, you know, they called up Trick Williams, they called up Obafemi, they called up Javon Evans. They're trying to add some more color to the WWE main roster, but like to me, out of those guys, from what I've seen, I think there's something with Javon Evans. I think he can connect with because of his age and because of his talent level and because of his wrestling style. He can connect with teenagers and kids as a cool. Modern personality in the ring. Whether or not the old white guys that write WWE can understand that remains to be seen. But in terms of like just like prospects, he's the most interesting because I do think that there's something there with his charisma and his in-ring ability that is going to be attractive to a younger demographic of fan. So those are the guys I would push just off the top of my head right there, not doing a ton of thought into it. Moving on, Adam Berger, longtime regular guest on the show, says, without any research, what are your initial thoughts and reactions to the new candidates for the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame in the US and Japan regions? So I'll say this, Adam. Of course, I've already done some research on these guys because I'm a voter. We don't just do our research, when the ballot comes out. We do our research year round, damn it. So we're going to list these guys off. I'll tell you, I'm just really quick thoughts. Walter Gunther, to me, really good wrestler, not a Hall of Famer. Definitely has a period of time where he is considered one of the best wrestlers in the world. I don't know how long that period of time is. I would say it's probably like 2017 to 2022, which I guess is a 5-year run that feels longer, but he's also not wrestling a huge schedule during that time period. But he's got to be work rate only because there's nothing there in anything else. But he to me he's not a Hall of Fame level worker. I think he's a really good wrestler. There's tons of Walter matches I really enjoyed. I think if he didn't go to WWE and he worked anywhere else, he'd be a stronger candidate because he just would have had so many more high quality matches and the opportunity to have high quality matches. Like the for a guy like that clearly is inspired by, Kings Road style All Japan and has talked about how that was such a huge influence in him. The fact that he just didn't work in Japan all the time is really frustrating from a career perspective. I'm sure everything's worked out for him really well financially since going to WWE, but for the Hall of Fame, I don't think that's helped his case. Batista just not he would it would have to be drawing case. I do think he like excelled as a professional wrestler, especially like later in his career when he especially when he was a heel. He's a great heel run. And I think his promos and, all-time look, I think probably like one of the three or four best pure looks in the history of pro wrestling in terms of just what you would think of when you think of a pro wrestler, of just this tall, insanely jacked guy with the beard and the crazy eyes and the intensity and just all-time look for that guy. It's not a surprise that he has gone on to have a very successful career in Hollywood. But not long enough of a career as a top guy. Was injured, spent a lot of time injured, especially after he'd kind of cracked the main event scene. Not a really good wrestler in ring. Not a huge draw in case. Like definitely was a top star and definitely headlined some pretty successful big shows. But to me, not a Hall of Famer in kind of any of the three categories. Despite, a very successful career in a lot of ways. Kane, I don't know why he's on this list. Kane always comes across really favorable when you look at like the Matt Farmer lists of like wrestlers who headlined shows that had at least 10,000 fans or more each year, just because he was such a reliable heel challenger of the month during like the Attitude Era and during successful times for WWE for a really long time. So if you want to look at like that, there's some level of drawing case, but I don't think that he is a Hall of Famer in any way, shape, or form. So to me, that's someone who's not going to get that much of a consideration from me. Booker T, kind of similar to Kane. He's probably a better in-ring wrestler than Kane, and he is a better, he's more charismatic and had more personality than Kane did. Didn't have nearly the type of like longevity as a main event star. Really wasn't a main eventer in WWE outside of like his King Booker run in that brief in that feud with Triple H leading up to WrestleMania 19. But he like really wasn't a main event wrestler. I mean, he won all his WCW championships, but everyone knows those weren't like real world title runs, dying days of WCW when they passed that title around like peppermints. So To me, he's not a voter, a candidate. Kenta, he's finally on the ballot. I'll have to think about Kenta more, is what I'll say, because like when I first started getting into like the IWC and talking about wrestling online, Kenta was like the god for people. And I kind of always approached him with like, he's good, but he's not that good. I'd have to go back and watch a lot of his like peak stuff. I do enjoy like the Kenta Marafuji tag team matches in Noah, when they're both at their peaks. And I think kind of like Walter, like Kenta one of the best wrestlers in the world at the time of his peak? He absolutely was, and I think he was more dominant in that conversation than Walter ever was. And he also seems to be probably a really historically significant wrestler in terms of, does seem like he was kind of the first, undersized guy to wear kick pads and, wrestle with kind of like this MMA inspired offense that obviously had a huge, huge influence on American indie wrestlers and CM Punk, and think about how many guys have emulated CM Punk or Bryan Danielson over the years. Like, so you can make a case for his historical significance in a positive manner, being big too. So to me, he's the strongest candidate of the new candidates on the list. Great Sasuke is another guy I will need to know, do some more research on, just because obviously he's had a really long career, and his career, working for Michinoku Pro Wrestling and Adventure of the Sasuke Special, and innovative high flying, not unlike Hayabusa, in a lot of ways, really important. I would have to dig more into his drawing record and kind of like what his like how can we view him as an in-ring wrestler? Is he one of the best in-ring wrestlers in the world? Did he? Because I'm not dismissing him, because I am sympathetic to wrestlers who are really successful in smaller Japanese wrestling promotions, especially excellent workers. So I'd have to do more research on him, but he has an interesting case, especially if you consider his historical significance, for being, part of that wave of 90s innovative high flyers. Tom Nakano, don't know a ton about her, to be honest. Like, haven't done a ton of research. Like, just my initial reaction to Tom Nakano is I know that she is, a Joshi wrestler. I know that she is part of like the kind of current boom in Joshi, I think, unless I'm confusing her with somebody else. I probably have seen her in matches. I'll have to check through like my logbook, to see. I'm sure she's been a part of some excellent matches. I don't know much about her. I'd have to do more research. I feel bad not saying anything, because it's po possible that I end up actually voting for her, but I can't say that yet. Kyoko Inoue, I think she's been on the ballot before, because I'm pretty sure I've done research on her and considered voting for her. I've seen like her signature matches from like the 90s in the All Japan women's wrestling days. Like, I've seen her signature matches with Manami Toyota, because Manami Toyota is one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. So I've seen like all of those big ones. In that Aja Kong, Dom Matsumoto kind of model of like the frumpy heavyweight, Japan women's wrestler that's beating the shit out of these idols all the time. So I enjoy Kyoko Inoue, a good time. Don't know if she's really a Hall of Famer. I don't know if she's would be considered one of the signature wrestlers of that period. Although she definitely, wrestled some major matches on big shows and things like that. But yeah, those are kind of just my general thoughts on the new candidates, and I'm sure we'll hear all about them later this year. Probably me and Adam talking together on them. So moving on, Richard O'Shea says, did Sinclair miss the boat by not going all in with Ring of Honor when they had something bubbling up with the Elite? Or was the Ring of Honor brand never going to be at that level? I think conventional wisdom is that Sinclair had an opportunity to kind of go all in with the Elite, and they've dropped the ball and they failed. And I understand the logic behind that, but I kind of agree with kind of what Richard touches on here in the back half, where he talks about the RH brand never going to be at that level. I think the most exciting thing about the Elite, like the most exciting thing about All In, the reason that show worked was not because it was Ring of Honor All In, even though in a lot of ways it was. It was because it felt like something new. It was not just another Ring of Honor show. It was the attempt to create this new thing. We didn't actually know it was going to end up, creating a whole new major pro wrestling promotion, because there was going to be a billionaire wrestling fan sitting in the front row being like, yeah, this will work. I'm going to pour millions and millions of my family's money into this project. We didn't know that was going to happen. But the reason it felt so big was because it was felt like a new, fresh thing that had never been done before. And Ring of Honor, was an old brand that had been around for a while and had been established at a certain level. And it's really difficult to suddenly get people invested in what they feel like is a known quantity, which is Ring of Honor is like a third tier pro wrestling company. And I love Ring of Honor, so I don't say that as an insult, but I just do think that the brand was never going to get it there. To the degree, I mean, Ring of Honor, they had the New Japan connection. They had the Elite. They had Kenny Omega on their shows. They signed Cody. They had him on his shows. They had all those guys, but it needed to be put into a different package. And that package was not going to be Ring of Honor. That's why, like, was the card at All In dramatically better than the card at like the show they ran in New Orleans that set their attendance record that drew like 6,000 fans, which I think was like Kenny Omega versus Cody Rhodes. It's mostly the same wrestlers on both shows, but one of them was a Ring of Honor show, and one of them was this new exciting thing. And I think that's why all AEW was able to come in and be successful, is because there was so much momentum for a new exciting thing, not just a, better version of something that already existed. And so I don't like a lot of people say like, oh, Sinclair could have done more, and they absolutely could have done more. They could have been more aggressive in the buildings they ran, although they ran Madison Square Garden, so I don't really know. I mean, obviously they ran it with New Japan and things like that, but I think they probably could have been more aggressive. But I think, like, honestly, everything worked out for the best in that regard. I mean, it didn't work out for the best for the Ring of Honor brand, because but that has a lot more to do with the pandemic and things like that that were unrelated to this question. Slight Confused says, what letter grade would you give wrestling as a whole? That's a very simple question. It's all it is. What letter grade would you give wrestling as a whole? I thought about this for a long time. What's an appropriate letter grade? And I said a B plus. And I say that because there were some things that I'm really concerned about in pro wrestling, but overall, I am entertained by pro wrestling. I don't find like I'm getting tired watching this stuff. I don't feel like I am like just there's nothing that interests me out there. I think that in most cases, the stuff that I watch has been entertaining, has been exciting. I think we have some interesting new wrestlers coming into the fold. I wish the business wasn't so lopsided and being dominated by a few promotions, but AEW has its faults, but oh my God, like, can you imagine if AEW didn't exist and like we just had WWE in America as a major company, and like whatever New Japan would be like? Would they be much better off if AEW didn't exist and they still had some talent, but would some of that talent have gone to WWE? Like, it's hard to say, but like compared to other eras where the choices that we had as wrestling fans were so limited, I would feel like things are really good. They're definitely better from like a diversity perspective, right? We have way better women's wrestling than we have ever had, especially in the United States at least, than ever before. So, but like AEW, I feel like is a really good promotion that entertains me most weeks and produces excellent pro wrestling matches and has interesting characters and wrestlers that I like. And that's a major, well-funded promotion that's not going anywhere, so that feels good. New Japan, I know I just railed on their booking, but the thing about New Japan is that they still do a lot of stuff that I really like. And I'll probably never like quit New Japan, because there's still that wrestling style and a lot of good wrestlers on the roster and exciting people that I do want to see. And so they're doing, even though there's a lot of frustrating aspects to New Japan, I still think there's a lot of positives for that company. The indies aren't what they once were, but you know what? I watch some of these indie wrestling, and it's definitely like I'm not watching any five star classics or anything, but I still find ways to appreciate it. And the YouTube, as I discussed, is really accessible, so it's way easier to find all this stuff. that before. I don't watch Joshi much, and I don't watch CMLL that much, but it seems to me like the fans that do watch those shows absolutely love, what's going on at Stardom and what's going on in CMLL and some of the other Joshi promotions, Tokyo Joshi Pro. I know, Stardom had the whole split with Marigold, and there's probably some divisive feelings regarding, that split impact it had. But it seems like the people that are in those circles really, really enjoy that. So, like WWE shit, but they're always gonna be shit. So like, I would say B plus. Like things could be better, but I think that overall, wrestling is entertaining me. Do I have like a utopic ideal in my head where like things could be a lot better if we just did X, Y, and Z? Yeah, but given the realities at hand, I think that this is we're in a good spot. EE says, would it be better for wrestling shows to go back to 1 hour format, even if they have multiple shows across the week, or just a 90-minute show? Like as a consumer, yeah, I'd be interested in like wrestling, weekly wrestling, especially AEW being less time consuming, right? It's hard to make 2 hours for Dynamite, 2 hours for Collision, and then more time for the pay-per-views every single week. I'm not going to be able to do that every week. I'm going to miss some stuff, and I'm also going to miss, some of this other stuff if I want to watch other promotions. I think most wrestling fans, in a lot of ways, would pine for less content just because it makes stuff easier to watch and this to be like feel like a more manageable hobby to be fulfilled by. That being said, we'd have to think of the ramifications for that, right? If they all went to 1 hour format, would the companies, especially like AEW, wouldn't be nearly as valuable to their television partners. So they would have less of that inherent financial security that comes from television deals because they're only producing 1 hour of television. So would a weaker AEW, or I guess a weaker WWE, would that be better for the wrestling industry? I think a lot of people would say yes, but we don't really know the answer to that, so it could be no. Another ramification would be like if we go to 1 hour, what is being cut, right? It's not going to be the main event wrestlers. It's not going to be the top stars. So we're going to see losses. We're going to see, less undercard wrestlers, less depth on each promotion, less diversity being pushed. Like, you think that the women would get the same time that they do now if the shows went down to 1 hour? Absolutely not. That's a consequence of there being so much hours to fill on television. There's more time for whether it's women's wrestlers, undercard wrestlers, mid-carders, tag team divisions, whatever you want to do. That's getting more TV time because of the sheer volume of television. So if you go to 1 hour, we're going to see that get cut, and it's going to be like you're going to watch a WWE show, and it's going to be like Cody and the Bloodline, and then it's going to be over, and CM Punk, and that's all they're ever going to do. If you're going to watch AEW, it's going to be MJF and whatever like Hangman is up to, and like maybe like the Elite, and then we're going home. Like that's what it would be. So the sheer volume has created a lot of opportunity for wrestlers who maybe otherwise wouldn't get it. So I don't know if that would be better or not. Would it, would it lead to less stockpiling? Would that create talent elsewhere? I talked about the indies struggling because they don't have the top talent. They don't have the best matches like they used to. Well, if AEW has a much smaller roster because they only have 1 hour of television, WWE has a less smaller roster because they only have 1 hour of television, does that spread out the talent? We have more promotions that have like interesting, exciting wrestlers that fans are going to get into. They also have more time to watch these promotions. Does that create a healthier overall wrestling environment? It very well could. It's all hypothetical because they're not going anywhere. Because this is a content creation market right now. These companies are paid to produce as much content as possible. Like Nick Khan said, like he would like Raw to be 12 hours long because they would get paid with that. That's just the way the business is. So, but it is kind of interesting. I think a lot of people pine for these days where they could spend less time watching wrestling and still stay up to date on everything, but that's just not the way the economy works these days. Refuse Party Program goes, ask me this question. What piece of media you've ever consumed did you learn the most from? Man, I don't know how to answer that question. The most transformative piece of media that I've ever consumed in my life. When I was a kid, I read Bill James's Baseball Abstract, which some other nerds would be familiar with. And is this gigantic 1,000-page book that is essentially like a breakdown of the history of baseball. And my dad got it for me when I was like 6 years old, like the revised edition that came out in like 2001. And I've been poking and reading it ever since. I think that it cr like created this like historical interest in me. I want to know more about something. In this case, it was baseball and baseball history and all these players that make up the history of baseball. And I think getting a chance to discover that in this gigantic book that was way too big for me to read, when I was a kid. But I think that started me down a path of curiosity of learning about different things, and especially when it comes to sports, wanting to know as much as I can about something, reading, listening to people, thinking about all this stuff from a historical perspective. And that has led me to probably influence my wife in a lot of ways, and probably indirectly led to me becoming a journalist and wanting to learn and know more about things, which is ultimately, the crutch of my job is that. So the Bill James Baseball Abstract, very informative, kind of semi-related. It's a very different style of book, but Bill Simmons's Book of Basketball, which came out, much later. I read that, as a teenager, probably also influenced me a lot of ways in that regard. So those are the kind of media that I think probably influenced me the most, and because those are my formative years, did I learn the most from? Another book that people would like to that I would recommend to anybody is a book called The Warmth of Other Suns. It's by Isabel Wilkinson. It is a book chronicling the history of the Great Migration, which, if you're unfamiliar with it or if you're not from the United States, the Great Migration touches on a period of time roughly between 1900 to 1960, where enormous amounts of Black Americans left the South, where a lot of them had lived their entire lives, and moved to the North or the West Coast or the Midwest, or basically to get industrial jobs. So it was like, all these people moving up from Mississippi to Chicago or to Detroit or to, San Francisco or any of these places. And the reason that I bring it up is it's a really interesting book, and it's about an interesting topic in American history, but really touchy. It's just incredibly written. It's incredibly researched. I think she spent about 10 years doing interviews with just hundreds of different people, and it's written over a long period of time. So she's interviewing people who immigrated during different periods of the Great Migration and went to different parts of the country and came from different backgrounds and had different successes and different failures. And it's a really, really wonderfully written book that I highly recommend to anybody. If I ever say, like, what's the best nonfiction writing I've ever read, it's that book. She has a follow-up book. It's called Cast that came out a couple years ago. That's a much more of like an academic book writing, like she's defending a thesis as opposed to a piece of journalism, which is how I would describe The Warmth of Other Suns. But highly recommend it to anyone that's interested in it. Someone else asked me this question. I feel bad because I actually forget and couldn't find where this question was asked, but I know it was asked last week, and I think it might have been Refused Party Program, but I lumped it in here at the bottom. But it might not have been, so I apologize in advance. But I actually, like, when I was going back and like going into like the Discord to find the questions, I couldn't find this one. But I swear this question was asked of me. So someone said, like, and this is the gist of the question because I don't remember the exact words, but said, as a fan of American sports and European sports, how do you think American sports would fare without a draft and instead used a more European style for talent dispersal? So this came up like a lot, like when we talk about tanking in like American sports, specifically the NBA, but it happens pretty much in every sport that has a draft, right? You finish the season with the worst record, you are either going to or most likely to get the top draft pick in the upcoming draft. It's the simplest, most direct way to rebuild if you're a bad team. In Europe, which of course uses the relegation model for European soccer, this can't happen, right? Because if you finish in last place, you get literally booted out of the team and replaced the best performing teams from the second tier. So this can't happen. So it's always one of those things where like European fans are always puzzled of how American fans can tolerate this, because it's a problem that doesn't exist in Europe because of the way their system works. And in Europe, the talent dispersal is way, way, way different in the sense of, I would say, like, the closest thing is like Americans. So European, it's just kind of like a free for all, right? When you're getting young players, you can just sign them kind of at any time. But what happens is The European model is you basically the club runs all of these youth teams and these academy teams all the way down to, I don't know how young, but let's say five years old. And you'll have players who will start with an academy team when they're like 7 or 8 years old, and they'll stay with that academy team for all the way up until they keep progressing and they reach the professional team when they're 16 or 17 years old, and they end up making their debut for the top team, the professional team. And that's how they get their talent, more or less. There's of course the transfer system when you buy players from other teams, which is a whole different market. But I think what they're getting at with this question is kind of like, what if America abolished the draft and just went with, players that reached eligibility age would be able to sign with anyone, which has been talked about as a solution to tanking, right? What if we just got rid of the draft and it becomes like, players are not forced to be drafted by a team they don't want to go to or don't want to play for. They can sign with whatever they want. And America's not ready for that. That will never happen for a number of reasons. American sports, there is a version of American sports that does do this. It is baseball does this, but only concerning international players, where every team gets a set amount of international money that they can spend each year, and they go and they use that money to sign prospects from outside the United States, which means that they're often signing like, 14 or 15 or 16 year olds from the Republic or Venezuela or Puerto Rico or one of these baseball playing countries. Although some Puerto Rican players do enter the traditional draft, because I'm pretty sure like Carlos Correa and Francisco Lindor were drafted. But basically, that is a system that they use. I think a lot of American fans, ironically, like people associate America with like ruthless capitalism and exploitation and, doing whatever it takes to win and that kind of stuff. I think American fans would have a real hard time with like the idea of treating like teenage athletes as professionals the way that in especially European soccer, where players are 15, 16 years old, they're getting signed to professional contracts. They're getting signed to different academies, right? Like Lionel Messi was signed by Barcelona when he was like 11 years old. They plucked him out of Argentina, gave him some HGH, put him in, La Masia, and voila, greatest player of his generation. So I think Americans like would have a hard time like acknowledging that these guys are going to be professionals, because like I remember people were talking about this like with like it was DeAndre Ayton was the character. It was right before the draft, which would have been what, like 2017, 2018, the Luka draft, which DeAndre Ayton went number one overall, and they were talking about like him as a professional. It's like, okay, he played a year in college, now he's gonna be professional. Is he gonna be ready to be a professional? And someone pointed out, like, if DeAndre Ayton was born in France instead of he was, he's from the Bahamas, but instead of, essentially being an American basketball player, like he would have been a professional player when he was 15 or 16 years old. Instead, we live in this world in America where it's like, are we sure that a player who's 19 is going to be mature enough to be professional? We're worried about paying college athletes who all, have to be at least 18 years old. There's a real concern about, making those kids famous and giving them a lot of money and those kids making poor decisions and things like that. I don't think in America, for whatever reason, we are not comfortable. We are not ready to professionalize children at a younger age, the way that it's just culturally seems less important. In European sports, I remember reading second Harry Kane mention of the podcast. I was reading like I think it was like a Players Tribune article written by Harry Kane. He talked about as people who are soccer fans will know that Harry Kane was originally in Arsenal's academy, and he eventually got cut by Arsenal's academy, and he signed up with Tottenham's academy, and then went on to become one of Tottenham's greatest players of all time, club's all-time leading scorer. And it was kind of like always this joke, like, oh, he was really an Arsenal fan, which Arsenal's Tottenham's biggest rivals. But I remember in the Players Tribune, Harry Kane talks about how devastating it was for him to be cut from Arsenal, and he didn't even know if, if he could was going to be a professional soccer player, and he, went to the park with his dad and broke down in tears, and it was this whole thing. And then, like, it turned out that like Harry Kane was like 9 years old when that happened. And it's like, okay, that's crazy that like he's thinking about his professional soccer career might be over when he's 9 years old. Like, seriously. And it's just different in Europe. So I don't know. I don't think America would stomach it. And there's all sorts of problems with competitive balance. As much as American fans complain about their sports leagues and the competitive balance in those leagues, it is far, far more balanced. All four major team leagues are so much more balanced than European soccer. It's not even close. Those leagues, like compared from an American fan, like the European soccer leagues are like comically unbalanced in terms of which teams are allowed to compete and which teams are fighting for mid-table slots and what teams are going to be relegated kind of no matter what. It's ridiculous. Model from an American perspective. And I don't think if you get rid of the draft and you start, which is a very like the draft is a very like socialist kind of approach to sports. Like the worst teams are going to get the best options to get picks in hopes that they get better. And the better teams are going to get worse picks in hopes that they don't get too good. It's a Karl Marx would be proud of the American sports system. I can't say the same about the European model. Anyway, those are my answers to that question that someone asked. And this is the last question I have for this podcast. It is from S. Dakota Jones. It is a non-wrestling question, so people who don't want to hear me talk about this can log off. But he says, hold on one second. He says, what are some, oh, went away again. Apologies for this delay. He says, what are some feasible steps we can take to fight the terrible media literacy and disinformation currently? Obviously, this is a huge question, but just looking for something to overcome the despair that, quote, nothing matters, LOL, and just assume that everyone is going to be willfully ignorant and actively terrible no matter what we do from years to come. Well, that's a very cheery question, S. Dakota Jones. I appreciate you asking me it. That's just the way I want to go out, is talking about how everyone just wants to be willfully ignorant and everything is going to be actively terrible no matter what we do from years to come. I was thinking about this like first step, right, for this. Support media outlets doing real work, right? Don't be afraid to pay for news. Obviously, that keeps people like me employed, but is like something that's like really important in terms of going forward. Don't rely on aggregators. Don't rely on clips on social media to get your news source from that. Share them on social media. Encourage other people to read and consume. And I think a big step is like take it upon yourself to challenge the people in your own life about information. If you hear somebody talk, oh, I saw this. Okay, where did you see that? Okay, like, do you think that's going to be a reputable source? It might come across as really annoying at first, but it's a way to kind of change the conversation from just believing everything people see online or not people who have limited media literacy falling for not like I'm not even saying like AI slop, but like a tricky headline, a biased outlet, even just poor reporting in general. But kind of challenge people who you're talking to about where they're getting this information from and what, why that might not be the best way for them to get their information. I think like the kind of human outreach and engagement factor are really important. I don't agree with like I think it's dangerous to assume people like want to be ignorant and that they're not going to care about the issues. I think your focus should be to try to work to inform them on the issues and then focus on the barriers that prevent people from caring, right? People are too distracted these days. People are, getting their information from non-reliable sources. How can we beef up those sources? The more I think about this as a journalist, seeing what's happening at the local level, and then also think about like the national, international level, the consolidation of these news sources, right? We're going to be headed towards a world where the Ellison family owns CBS, but now they also own CNN, and we're going to start seeing these media sources be, which are going to be, very politically slanted, owned by a few handful of billionaires. So how do we combat that? I really do think the future is going to be nonprofit news. There are already some really good nonprofits out there, especially at the local level. I see, like, I work for a big conglomerate. We abandoned some communities, stopped covering them altogether, closed their papers down. And those communities have been replaced by nonprofit newsrooms that maybe they only have one or two employees, but they do a good job with what they can covering their local communities. And you also see that at the national, international level. And I do think that's the future is going to come from smaller news organizations, ones that are working as nonprofit that don't exist at, as a piece of meat that a private equity firm can scrape all of the value out of and then dump. And so that's where I think the future is going. So support your nonprofit newsrooms as well. But that's pretty much all I have. I really appreciate everyone who send these very thought-provoking questions. I know it's not entirely wrestling based, but that's okay because that at least means people think that I'm cognizant enough at an intellectual level to talk about issues beyond pro wrestling. So I appreciate the thoughtful questions. Some of them really made me think. So hopefully other people are interested in this and can, if they want to talk about the Irish potato famine, I'm all ears to have a whole conversation about it. It'll be the whole next episode of my podcast. It'll just be the discussions about the Irish potato famine. But thanks a lot, and I'll talk to you again after a while.
Wrestling Omakase brings you a full course meal of all of Japanese wrestling, men's and women's. Join me, a Japanese wrestling fan for over 20 years, along with a rotating cast of equally knowledgeable co-hosts, as we cover everything from New Japan and Stardom to NOAH, All Japan, DDT, Tokyo Joshi, Marigold, Sendai Girls, Dragon Gate, Glate, Ice Ribbon, and even more stuff. If you're a fan of Japanese wrestling and you want coverage of the entire scene in one podcast, check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network each and every week. Get us wherever you get podcasts today.